Big Adventures with Brian Durker is brought to you by Arizona River Runners. Just getting started on your own big adventures? Arizona River Runners' three-day Grand Canyon Heli Ranch and Raft Trip blends authentic Western ranch experience with world-class whitewater. Explore secret waterfalls and drift to sleep on the banks of the Colorado River under a blanket of stars. Longer trips are available as well. Let Arizona River Runners take care of the details on your own big adventure. Visit raftarizona.com.
Welcome to Big Adventures with me, Brian Durker. Hey, my next guest is an old friend of mine, and he has a great story in a lot of different directions. But Matt and I have been working together for years within the scientific realm, particularly in the world of survey in Grand Canyon. There's a conventionally placed network of controls that have been, through many years, established along the corridor. He and I did a lot of that work together back in the day, and then we also developed, through the years, a really sophisticated hydrographic survey boat. And it's gone through a lot of phases, and technology has gotten better and better. And, oh, golly, in the end there, we built a really high-end, technically sound survey boat for multi-beam sonar. So we'll have fun listening to his explanations of what that's all about. But that's mapping the river bottom, and he has been a real key figure in that work for years and years. He's got a cooperative agreement coming out of Northern Arizona University, and it's in association with the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center and the USGS. And he's still doing a lot of mapping on the river bottom, and he's been in charge of the terrestrial mapping of the beaches as well. And we'll ask him all about that stuff. So I'm looking forward to you getting in on a very intelligent fellow's mind and humor. And he'll probably have an adventure for us to boot. So welcome, Matt Kaplinski.
Well, actually, I was on my way to the Air Force Academy, which is kind of there's some ground where you need to get a letter from your local congressman, this kind of stuff, to get accepted into the academy. I wanted to go and be an astronaut.
Oh, you really
and
missed out.
I sure took a turn because at some point I thought, the military? I don't think so.
Yeah, I can see how somebody might come to those terms.
Yeah. So went to Western Michigan, noodled around for, I went in there as like an aeroscience. They have a pretty good aviation engineering program there. Went into aeroscience engineering. The first class, aeroscience engineering 101, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 8 in the morning. Needless to say, I went to about three of them and just stopped.
And bailed.
Done. Semester one, grade point 2.5, you know, just off the rails in the dorms there, you know, just having a ball. And yeah, took some classes for a couple years, took all kinds of classes and had all kinds of fun and ended up taking a class from a geology class and fell in love with it and then ended up getting into the geology program, getting a little more serious.
You know, I think a lot of kids should kind of approach it that way, is take a bunch of different stuff and see what lights you up a little bit.
Right,
before
yeah.
Before make that long-haul pursuit.
Right.
And then, so geology started getting your flair, and then you started getting more serious about the school. And
yeah, I did pretty good. Once I grabbed onto something that grabbed my attention and had my passion for it, did pretty good there. I got a geophysics degree, which is, you know, it's geology with the engineering physics program. And you
cool.
A lot of remote sensing kind of, you know, gravity surveys, seismic surveys, electric surveys, sort of higher tech. I was thinking maybe that'd be a better avenue into most likely the oil field.
Yeah.
That's where they were pulling bachelor degree holders right into the oil field at $70,000-$80,000 a year.
Well, and I suppose that industry is probably the leading edge in a lot of the technology push as well. I mean, they had the money, they had the drive.
Yeah, and they sure had the salaries. And then, but it's boom or bust. So, you know, I signed on when they were plucking people out of our program, and I was talking to them. They're like, yeah, making $80,000 a year here in Midland, Texas. I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. And then halfway through the program, somewhere around like 83 or 84, the bottom fell out and you needed to have a advanced degree to get any kind of job. And you
know, yeah, times changed.
Yeah, time changed pretty fast in the oil industry. Yeah. So
you continued going to school, and then did you transfer?
No, I got...
You got your degree there.
The guy I took the 101 class from, Chris Schmidt, ended up being a mentor of mine. Amazing guy. He was a structural geologist. When I was getting close to graduating, by that time I knew I needed to go get a master's degree. So I was looking at schools, and I did really good. Had a bunch of graduate classes. Anyways, Chris, he looked at me one day and he said, you know, Matt, I want you to apply to Northern Arizona University. I think you'd do good there. I think you'd like it there. I think it'd be a good place for you. And I was applying to... I thought I was kind of a hot shot, and I was going to Stanford and all
Harvard,
these hot, you know, the big schools. And so sent one into NAU and got rejected from every single one of them.
Including NAU?
Including NAU.
Why on earth would they reject a great mind like yours?
Well, if you look on paperwork, those first couple of years at Western, really, I think my overall grade point, despite, you know, getting 4.0s in the later years, was still like 2.6 or 2.7.
Impediment.
Yeah,
for your...
yeah. The first semester was a 1.7. I was just an idiot.
If they only had beer drinking in the class,
right?
You'd have maintained your 4.0.
Right. And luckily, Chris Schmidt got angry because I got rejected from NAU. And he wrote a pretty decent letter for me to a guy he went to school with at Indiana University in the 70s, Dave Brumbaugh, and said, hey, Dave, if you want any more recommendations from me, you better take this kid and, you know, figure out how to get him into the school, because he's got potential and there's no reason you should reject it. You know, it was a really, I mean, I thank him to this day for doing that.
Oh, yeah. Because, he must have really believed in you. Right. He saw what he had.
And Dave Brumbaugh, too, because he went to bat for me and got me on at NAU in the master's program there.
And so that was like 85?
That was 80. Moved here in August of 1986.
86.
Yeah.
And then what program did you jump right into? The geology program here in
master's program in geology.
NAU is our local university here for the listener. It's a pretty nice university for a small Western town. It started out as Arizona Teachers College or even something before
Arizona
that.
Arizona State
Teachers College. But it's a good full-bodied university. We're lucky to have it in this town. The proximity for you to the Grand Canyon if you're a geologist, right?
Right, right.
And so talk a little bit about the NAU progression.
So when I came in, I had been in touch with Dave Brumbaugh, of course. He's a seismologist. And another geophysicist here, Dave Best, he had people doing gravity surveys and things like that, where you go out into like Chino Valley and you take these gravity measurements and it measures the change in gravity over a basin and you model how deep the basin fill is, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about doing something like that. And unbeknownst to me, that first semester, NAU Geology hired a new chairman, Paul Morgan, who was a geophysicist, and he's a heat flow guy. So he looks at the flow of heat coming out of the earth and how thermally the earth regulates itself. And he came in to his first, we called them tech sessions there, but it's the first, you know, meet and greet. And he introduced himself in front of the whole department. And at the end of it, he said, "And you know, I've just been doing some work up in Yellowstone National Park on Yellowstone Lake." And we were, we were dropping this heat probe on the bottom of the lake and measuring the heat flow up through the lake sediments. And he's like, "And we noticed that there's no bathymetric map of the lake that exists that's any good. So if anybody's looking for a project, I'm looking for a student to come up with me to Yellowstone and make a map of the lake bottom."
And you almost threw your shoulder out, throwing your hand up.
I followed him back to his office, chattering the whole way, and ended up doing that, working that project for 4.5 years. I got two master's degrees, typically a 2-year program. I tick 4.5.
Well, you know, good things come with time.
That's right.
What sort of, just to segue to that project, what sort of equipment were you using to measure the bathymetry and all that?
Right.
What kind of stuff were you doing?
The advancements in that technology are, it's been amazing to be in that industry and watch it up until today. So what we used back in, I spent the summer of 1987 to 1988 on Yellowstone Lake, and for locating the boat, for figuring out where the boat is on the lake, we had a microwave. This is pre-GPS.
Right.
There aren't any GPS satellites out there. So you had to, we had a microwave C-band system that has, you take two of these, there's two transponders that you put in locations on the side of the lake, and then you have a receiver on the boat that measures the distance between the receiving box and an antenna.
And then you can just triangulate.
And you triangulate from there, yeah. So you take these, they're 24-volt transponders, and you shinny up a dead tree on the edge of Yellowstone Lake and get them up there as high as you can, because it's a pretty big lake. I mean, it's 20 miles long by, it's a weird shaped lake if you've ever
seen the outline of it. It must have been a cool place to be.
It was just like a dream project, especially, you know, you look back on things you did and it's like, my God, boy, did I get lucky on that.
Yeah.
But you had, anyways, you scramble up into these trees and bungee these transponders and then haul a couple. It's 24 volts. You had to haul two 12-volt batteries up there and hook those up and get them running. And then for the sonar kit, for the depth sounder, we had a 20 kilohertz single beam
pinger.
Just pinger with a paper chart.
Right.
The old paper chart
static
thing. It's got a little motor with a sparker that spins around and sparks the paper and basically.
I think my early work with Julie Graff in Grand Canyon, we were using it's probably a similar device.
Yeah.
And then so then after that, were you able to garner your master's from that work? Or how'd it go beyond that project? What got you going with the Grand Canyon stuff?
The first trip I can't remember if it was myself or Joe Hazel. Joe and I came in August 1986, and we're both teaching undergrad geology labs. And he had in his lab, it was Joe. He had Jeff Gorley and Ray Interpreter.
Taking
a geology 101 class. And those guys are knuckleheads and great guys. And we ended up like hanging out with them after class. And Gorley invited me on a private trip.
Oh, wow.
And we had done, I think the first fall we were there, my first river trip ever was a San Juan trip. The fall I got there in 86, we did a full San Juan trip with a bunch of dirtbag geology graduate students. And anyway, we had a ball. And then I got on that, I launched on that private trip and ended up hiking out at Monument Creek, I think. But it was just amazing. I mean, it was December through January. We had New Year's Eve at Nankoweap. it was, you know, that, you know, the, it was the moment that you're like, wow, I think I've found my people.
My people and place. Right. Most and
yeah. Yeah. So not only being blown away by the place, but just the ease of it and how much fun everybody was having and, you know, a bunch of guides down there. It was really loose. And
yeah, we call that first trip in most everybody's experience the magic trip.
The magic trip, yeah.
And then, so after that trip, you're at NAU and doing what kind of work?
I was still working on my master's, and I was the department computer technician or something. And I think the summer of 1989 was pretty big for me, both scientifically and boating wise, because I did, we did two private trips, the 1987, 1988, New Year's Eve at Nankweep. We did another next winter, 88, 89. And then I got on as a baggage boat for expeditions. And that summer, July, 1989. And I also, my advisor, Paul Morgan, got invited on a Stan Buse trip.
Oh, wow.
And he couldn't go. And he was collecting mud. One of the projects they had was collecting mud from different tributaries and testing it for radioactive activity. Like how much background radioactive
material was
detritus is coming out of these, you know, naturally occurring systems.
Oh, interesting.
And so, and that's where I met you, Brian, on that trip.
Is.
You were driving the old Ichthyo fighter.
Yep, we were doing fisheries work. Steve Carruthers
Steve
and
Carruthers.
Norm Sharber, I think, was on that trip. The father of the variable voltage pulsator.
Right.
And we were doing some of that early work right around the time I was leaving expeditions.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. So that was the segue into our friendship.
Right.
And then so you started getting involved more with the science stuff in Grand Canyon post-private trips. And
post-private trips.
And the commercial
trips. And the commercial trips.
So you really wiggled right into the whole ball of wax.
Yeah, and on that, Larry Stevens was on that trip. And I remember Ted Mellis was on part of that trip. And we were at Grapevine. And Ted said... Ted said, this edition of Ted said.
Not anyways, to be confused he read, with Ted Talks.
He read the letter that ordered the EIS to be done.
Right.
I think it was Manuel Lujan.
Exactly.
That ordered the EIS. And I remember Ted saying, he's like, you know, this is going to change a lot of people's lives. And I think a lot of people that are on this trip are going to be really affected by that. I'll never forget that.
How futuristic of his thinking.
Yeah.
And it's the truth
so
of the matter.
So there you go.
It really did.
So meeting, having, you know, met Stan Buse and Larry Stevens and Steve Carruthers and you.
Yeah, who all became key players in
and
a
then,
lot of it.
You know. Yeah, and then after that, when the EIS was ordered, they were putting together crews and studies. And I got contacted by Larry that they were going to start doing these beach surveys. Did I want to be... come on and be a part of it.
And then, lo and behold, both of us were doing...
I raised my hand pretty quick on that one,
and,
too.
And, you know, just for you guys listening, in 1983, there was a malfunction at Glen Canyon Dam because they had a full pond for the first time. A quick history. The dam was built and completed by 1963. They started filling the reservoir in 1963. 20 years later, they finally had a full pond, Lake Powell.
Full pond in 1980.
Full pond in 1980. So they were right in that high pond.
Yep.
And then here comes 1983. They underestimated the inflow. It was a big winter in the Rockies and the San Juans and everywhere else. And they had this tremendous inflow that wasn't forecasted by their professionals.
Rain on snow.
And then a warm rain on lots of snow.
Yeah.
And then it just turned into a big-time crisis. The lake kept coming up, and they couldn't dump water fast enough. Sure enough, it started becoming clear to everybody that it was going to possibly compromise the structure. And they had the left bypass tunnel. They had to turn on or release water through the bypass tunnels, which they hate doing because it's not making electricity. They're just dumping water. They had a compromise in that left tunnel. It started spitting concrete. It was quite a time, the 83 events. And as a result of that, long story short, there was a tremendous amount of interest all of a sudden in the effects of Glen Canyon Dam on the lower basin and as well as the national park. And so a tremendous amount of scientific work was appropriated for getting an idea of what those releases and their effects actually had on the environment in Grand Canyon. And so, Matt, there wasn't ever an EIS done pre-construction of Glen Canyon Dam, right?
That's right. Yeah, it was, that's the term. It was ex post facto.
Ex post facto, yeah.
They didn't have the, I forget the name of the act, the 1973 Act of Congress that Nixon, of all people, pushed through that called for environmental impact state. There were none before the 70s. You didn't.
Right.
Nixon
was the early 70s. And
this was the first one that they did on, you know, retroactively. Well, let's go through.
And so what year was that decision made, or what year was that letter Ted was
1989.
It wasn't until 89 because in 84, we had already started doing a tremendous amount of baseline work to get an idea as to everything from the fishery to the old high water line. And what the high water line represents is before the dam, what was an annual average of high flow was like around 120,000 or something?
I think the mean is probably 80,000.
80,000.
Something like that.
So there's this very definitive line of the old vegetation that could survive down to the scour line of the seasonal high flows, which is mesquite and acacia and a few other species. And then annually, everything below that would get scoured. So it was just annuals that would get a hold and grow in that lower riparian zone, and then they get scoured out in the early summer and spring.
And you'd get some nascent growth. Like if a lot of time, you know, mean of 80,000, but highly variable, you might have had peaks in some years pre-dam that were 40,000, you know, in a dry year.
Right.
So you'd get things in that zone, but then when the next big flow would come through, they'd get blasted out.
Right. And I think what was it in 1884 or something? They predict it was around 400,000 or something.
Some huge flow. I think upwards of two. I'd have to look at, of course, Dr. Topping has reanalyzed all those estimates.
He'd be a fun one to get on this here.
Yeah. He would remember those exact numbers, and I don't at this point, but it's in the 200,000s.
But long story short on that is that scour happened, but what was left behind were a tremendous surplus of sediment, sand, that came from the upper basin. And so then in comes the dam. It stops those high flows, stops that inflow of sediment, and so the sediment is either disappearing downstream or with the lower velocities of flows drop into the bottom of the river. And so basically, Matt, you made an entire career out of that phenomenon, didn't you?
Pretty much.
You want to explain some of that?
So when the test flows started, or the research into the EIS started, there were all kinds of studies. Our focus was on looking at the sediment resources and looking at sandbars in particular. So we went down there and did topographic surveys on, I think there were 33 in those early years that we did. And we would do repeat topographic surveys. So you'd compare one survey to the next survey, and you'd look at how it changed, and you'd measure the bulk volume and look at what elevation zones are getting eroded or deposits,
right,
things
right.
like that. Sometime in the maybe 1996, I think, by the time that first high flow went along, we had gotten into a program of doing bathymetric surveys because we knew, you know, the sandbars are sort of the top of a big pile of sand, most of which is underwater. So if you want to look at topographic change of the sand, you need to look under the water. And you need to do bathymetric surveys as well as surveys up on the shore. And so that process is pretty fascinating just because as the whole industry was evolving as we came through that time period. And think like you remember the early days, we were tracking the boat. This is pre-GPS days when I think GPS in the early 90s was available, but only for the military and
the accurate GPS.
They had these handheld things that you had to go through. Pre-GPS, we had people standing behind instruments with clutches and scopes tracking a boat. They're just standing there looking at a boat, trying to keep the instrument on target.
And just so you guys know, the survey gun would be tracking the boat. And the whole reason for that is so that they could identify the position of that boat out on the water. And it was a very labor-intensive way to do it, but they didn't have GPS, right?
So. And so even for the ground surveys, what we did over the course of that initial the test flows in 1990 to 91 is we developed a way to measure the topography using total stations, a technology that was also coming along. At first, a total station is an instrument. It's an optical instrument. You look through it and you place the crosshairs of this 10X scope on somebody standing on a beach, in our case, and it records the position of that point and the elevation of that point. At first, we were laying out these grids on the beach and going back and trying to reestablish that grid and measuring each point again, staking out each of those points and measuring the elevation difference at those points. And pretty soon, we thought, well, why don't we just make, let's just cover the beach with points from this thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And remember that at some point during those initial surveys, data collectors became available. At the first surveys, we were sitting there writing down to the total station. You swing it to a point and it records the
coordinates.
You have to write down the slope distance, the distance from the center of that instrument to the prism that the person is carrying. And then you have to write down the horizontal angle and the vertical angle. So you're writing down these three numbers for each shot on a clipboard. So it takes two people to operate. And then I forget the exact timing when it became available, but they had these little handheld data collectors that you just plug into the data to the total station and you hit the button and it stores it automatically. So all of a sudden you have
half of the amount of people
there, and you can spray the beach with points. And we just kind of ran with that and developed our whole way of surveying beaches through that.
And then use the
same instrument to track the boat as it's going out back and forth along the shore, which is tricky because it's moving the whole time. When you survey on the beach, you run to a spot, you stop, and you point your prism at whoever's running the gun. And they take a shot. With a boat, it's moving.
So you have to
develop ways to track it.
As the technology improved, you put together what are fondly known through the community as the NAMDOR team. You want to talk a little bit about the NAMDORs and the base of that?
Yeah, we had from 1990 to 91. This is when we first started, they went after it pretty hard. We did 22 surveys of those 33 sites. And each time we did a survey, we launched four trips simultaneously.
Right. And I was involved with that.
Yeah. And we had a, So the test flows did, they went through all kinds of variables of flow releases from the dam for a whole year. They'd run steady 8,000 for 2 weeks. And then for 4 days, they'd drop it down to 5,000, steady 5,000 cubic feet per second. And then after that, they'd go into another one, another 2 week test period where they'd run high fluctuations. Or anyways, so they did these 22 different scenarios. And in between each one of those, we'd go down and survey the beaches, the 33 beaches.
Yeah, it was intensive.
And because we only had 4 days to do it, we had to launch four trips simultaneously. We had one, the first trip went upstream to Glen Canyon and surveyed down to South Canyon, I think. The next crew, when the water went down, would start at Nautiloid and survey down to Phantom. And the next crew went from Phantom to below Deer Creek.
Yep.
And then the last crew went from
the lower stretch.
The lower stretch, yeah. So we had this huge crew of people doing trips all throughout the year. And there we developed a certain amount of camaraderie. After that, in, I think, 92 or 93, we started, we got another grant from the Bureau of Reclamation, or it might've been the Park Service, to continue monitoring the sites as the environmental impact statement was developed. At that point, we went into once or twice a year doing these surveys. So the select crew from all of the, you know, the madness of the test flow period, those 22 trips, we were able to
The A team.
We were able to, you know, skim the cream of the crop from the top. And those crews, that's where we initially developed the NAMDOR, the NAMDORs, it's Rodman spelled backwards. And it all stems from Spoon. One of the cream of the crop was this guy named Greg Sponenberg. He's an architect down in Phoenix that volunteered for these trips. And he was great. He was just a character. And one night, in some kind of scotch-induced thing, he started turning words around. And like Rodman, he would call it NAMDOR. Gunner, the instrument operator, we called him Gunners. He was calling him Renugs. But he was doing it in real time without missing a beat.
Yes, he was super smart guy.
Just ridiculous. And out of that little incident where we were just rolling on the ground laughing, NAMDOR was one of the phrases that stuck. And then we became, that's what we called ourselves from then on.
From the NAMDORs, from yeah.
We called ourselves the NAMDORs.
Fantastic. And we'll move on beyond this. But one thing I want to just mention, when in those early surveys, we were doing lines off of the shoreline to try and get an idea of the shoreline profile into the river. And so we'd back away with the boat on a fixed line while somebody's trying to locate us with the gun, and then reel it back in and then do the next one. And we had all these transects offshore. When did it start developing into actual hydro boats out there doing full profiles of
full
the river
pool
bottom?
Surveys
full
of the
pool
thing.
Surveys.
Pretty sure that was in 93, 94 when we started bringing those things in.
Yeah, because we were pretty established with it by 96 using single beam, and we were just on the brink of this new technology.
Yeah.
Multi-beam.
Multi-beam came in that first trip we did together in 1999.
Right.
The old, what was that? The Rezon 9001.
The Rezon 9001, and there was a guy, Mark Gonzalez, who was very...
Gonz was
very instrumental in the development of our early configurations of what kind of boat and what kind of tracking. And now, when did robotic tracking come into it?
2002.
Yes,
we
somewhere.
Did the first, those first, we called them fist. The fist reaches.
The fist reaches.
The
right.
11 fist reaches, yeah. I think that was the first time we had those old geotometers.
And so what
that Gonz researched and put together.
Yeah,
and
he really brought the thing.
He was instrumental for sure.
Extremely. Now he, the robotic thing was, there's a laser on the target on the boat. The boat's in radio contact with the gun. And so you had full-time, real-time location. The gun was on these motors that you'd fix the laser onto the theodolite or the target.
A robotic total station locks onto a target, an active target. It's powered. It has power. And there's all kinds of different technologies to do that. It's another thing that's still evolving. But basically, it locks onto that target and follows it. It just locks on and follows that target, and then it radios or telemeters those numbers that we were talking about, the slope distance, the horizontal and vertical angle, back to the boat. And those numbers are stored in the data collection computer that's recording all the multi-beam the sonar data and the motion data, and also with the robotics, the position data.
Yeah, and then that is all processed real time, and then stored.
It's stored real time, and there's a real time display. So you drive around, being tracked. So you actually have this map view of the boat moving along that displays the track of the boat, and it displays a footprint of the sonar as it's being collected.
Not to mention heave, pitch, and roll.
That's involved
of the data.
And all of that's displayed. So basically, when you're driving up and down the river, you're mowing the lawn almost. You're looking at this screen and you're driving up and down the river, filling in the pixels on the screen to make sure you've got your 100% coverage on the bed.
Yeah, it's really cool. And Matt and I were lucky enough to do a lot of this together. And I do emphasize a lot.
Yeah.
But we were also lucky enough to have a bunch of money given to us to build our idea of what the perfect multi-beam boat was.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
You're still probably using that
absolutely.
Boat.
That boat is ideal.
But we had a ball configuring this thing first and foremost around the scientific need or the technical needs for the operation. And then we incorporated that into the operation of the boat. And it's a beauty. We came up with a beauty. And
those were
great days building that boat.
That was... We got the frame, sort of a skeletal snout frame.
Which was our dimension and design. And then
preferred
we got
size.
That frame, and then it was all systems full.
It was a month and a half. That was in 2008.
Right.
January of 2008, and we were launching a trip because there was a high flow release from the dam in March, I think. And we were scheduled to measure, to go out before the high flow. We had a trip launching in February. We were turned around and did a trip on the high flow. And then we turned around and did a high flow trip. Anyways, we needed a new boat. And we got the frame in January. And we had all the fabrication done, all the head scratching, put that whole thing together.
You and I did some all nighters.
We just hammered
scraping
that.
And sawing,
sawing
and drilling and
measuring.
testing.
Oh God, that was, I mean, we knew it at the time, right? We were going,
history.
We are never going to be able to do this again.
And I'm really pleased when I see that boat down there and you operating it. To this day, it's a real active operation that Matt's conducting in the hydrographic survey world down there. And then in regards to the frequency and when you're doing, at this point, you've got the lion's share of the river bottom mapped, your baseline, and you've done multiple returns and repeat surveys so that you can do volumetric comparisons of the river bottom sediment storage.
Right. Yeah. The question.
Explain that.
Well, the question is, are the, so in 2012, they, they established this high flow protocol where anytime there's enough sediment input by the Paria River, they're going to run a flow out of the dam above power plant capacity or a high flow or controlled flood to move that sediment back up onto the beaches. One of the main questions is there enough sand to sustain that over a long period of time, 50, 100 years? The way to answer that is to do these, well, our way of answering that is to do these repeat bathymetric surveys of initially 30-mile reaches. We're now doing 60-mile reaches and measure the bulk volume in. The first reach we did was from Silver Grotto to the Little Colorado River, so lower Marble Canyon section. So you repeat that survey. We repeat it in 2009. We did that 30-mile reach, and we repeated that in 2012. You can compare those two surveys and come up with a number that's the bulk amount of sediment either gone or, you know, either eroded or deposited in there. Over the long term, if the amount of sediment based on those comparisons is showing a trend of decreasing, you know, every time you go down there, you measure erosion. Eventually, you're going to run out of sand to build those beaches with high flows.
Yep, exactly.
And so that's what we're trying to answer by doing these repeat bathymetric surveys above and beyond. I mean, another part of that, to me anyways, we within our group, we have these arguments all the time. Just having a baseline map of the bed, a topographic map of the bed of the Colorado River is a goal of mine. Having that, I mean, that's in 2019, there's places in the Grand Canyon that are not mapped. We don't have a topographic map
and
on the bottom of some of them.
And haven't been seen.
Right.
And that was the thrill, quite frankly, of doing this with this equipment. You can be it was like being in a spaceship exploring new worlds. We get a, especially like the first time we did the upper gorge, getting a topographic image of the river bottom. It was the last unexplored element really of the Grand Canyon. So it's a thrilling work.
There's a sense of discovery and exploration to it.
Yeah, there really is.
It's rare to get in these times.
You're
filling in a blank on the map.
Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. A simple question like, is there enough sand?
Yeah.
It's an easy question to ask, a pretty tricky
but
one to
answer.
But it's
a million-dollar question to answer, for sure. Isn't it? And that's the whole thing is, answers take a lot of time down there, whether it's your work or whether it's Mike Yard's work with the fisheries or whether it's the veg people's work. The answer, it's not the immediate gratification the scientist gets, but you guys have a pretty good claw into it.
Yeah.
And, that's,
well, it's pretty sad. Just doing the work itself is pretty darn satisfying, as you know.
Well,
how unique and how special it is to be able to do what we do down there.
Oh, yeah.
That's not lost on us.
No, it's not lost at all. It's the greatest days of our lives have been spent.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
The whole name of my podcast is Big Adventures, and that has been, in its own right, a pretty huge adventure. As far as you look at the progression through the years of the techniques, the technical equipment, the study design, I mean, that's a heck of an adventure you've been on with
Absolutely.
Your work. We're kind of running out of time, but I really, Matt, you and I have had a fantastic bunch of fun. I'm looking forward to more fun.
Likewise.
But thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I love you like a brother.
Likewise. It's fantastic to be here. You've been a big part of my life for 30 years or so, and it's great to talk to you about it.
Life is rich with you, brother.
It is. Right on, man.
Thank you.
Let a Grand Canyon River trip be your big adventure. Arizona River Runner's 3-day, 2-night trip gives you the enchantment of a Western ranch experience, the thrill of a helicopter ride through millions of years of geology, and the rush of Colorado River Rapids. Take a weekend to unplug as the Arizona River Runners' talented guides show you the best of what the Grand Canyon has to offer. Visit raftarizona.com to learn more. Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Buchner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.